Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Rabbi Yomi Azikwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Rabbi Yomi Azikwe. Today is Saturday, September 2nd, 2023. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on in our program, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the most recent coup in Gabon, where yet another former French colony has fallen to military forces. The CNSP government in Niger has demanded the withdrawal of the French ambassador from the capital of Niamey. Revelations about the 1980 assassination attempt against the martyred Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has surfaced. And the United Nations peacekeeping troops are facing protests in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. In the second hour, we look in detail at developments in Niger and Gabon over the last week. Finally, we will honor the 44th Detroit Jazz Festival with music from Regina Carter and a rare archival interview with Horace Silver. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned, and we'll take our musical interlude with Regina Carter, Detroit's own Regina Carter, who is playing this year at the Detroit Jazz Festival in downtown Detroit. Regina Carter was born on August the 6th of 1966. She is an African-American jazz violinist. She is the cousin of jazz saxophonist James Carter. Carter was born in Detroit and was one of three children in her family. She began playing piano and taking piano lessons at the age of two after playing a melody by ear for her brother's piano teacher. After she deliberately played the wrong ending note at a concert, the piano teacher suggested she take up the violin, indicating that the Suzuki method could be more conducive to her creativity. Carter's mother enrolled her at the Detroit Community Music School when she was just 4 years old, and she began studying the violin. She still studied the piano as well as tap and ballet. As a teenager, she played in the youth division of the Detroit Symphonic Orchestra. While at school, she was able to take master classes from Isaac Perlman and Yehudi Mahuhin. Carter attended Cass Technical High School with a close friend, jazz singer Carla Cook, who introduced her to Ella Fitzgerald. In high school, Carter performed with the Detroit Civic Orchestra and played in pop-funk group named Brainstorm. In addition to taking violin lessons, she also took viola, oboe, and choir lessons. Carter was studying the classical violin at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston when she decided to switch to jazz. She transferred to Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan, where she was a jazz major under the direction of Marvin Doc Holliday. She also studied and performed with trumpeter Marcus Belgrave. Through Belgrave, Carter was able to meet musicians active in the Detroit jazz scene, including Lyman Woodard. She graduated in 1985. After graduating, she taught strings in Detroit public schools. Needing a change of scene, she moved to Europe and lived in Germany for 2 years while making connections. She worked as a nanny for a German family and taught violin on a U.S. military base. And we'll have more information on the career of Regina Carter, who played at the Detroit Jazz Festival this evening in downtown Detroit, the 44th annual Detroit Jazz Festival. Let's listen to a live concert of Regina Carter at the Newport Jazz Festival on August 15th of 1998, some 25 years ago. Let's listen in.
Welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, to the JDC Jazz Festival in Newport. One of the largest presenters of straight ahead jazz to the tune of about 117 hours loose. You get out there, check it out. Be sure to use plenty of sunscreen and keep yourself with lots of drinks and French of Earth, kind of be hot on a beautiful afternoon. And it's my privilege and my pleasure to introduce the opening act of this first official day of the all-day festivity here at Fort Adams State Park. Hailing from Detroit with a connection here in New England by way of the New England Conservatory, having studied there both classically and studied in the African-American music, classical music and jazz. If you've ever seen or had the privilege of witnessing Blood on the Field, the Pulitzer Prize-winning jazz oratorio by Wynton Marsalis, there's a stunning moment when the following performer comes out and just in essence takes over the entire captivity of your attention and the audience. From Detroit, Downbeat Critics Poll winner 2 years in a row, Atlantic Recording star, Ms. Regina Carter.
Listen here. Listen here. Eddie Harris. This next tune is a tribute to a man who helped open the doors for this instrument in the jazz idiom. People always say you can't play jazz on violin, but there have been a few of us out here and many more coming that are proving that point to be so wrong. And this dedication is a George Gershwin tune, and I'm dedicating it to Stephan Grappelli. Not mimicking him, but thanking him. And it's our own version of Lady Be Good, so we hope you enjoy. Lester Garnett on drums. You ever get all dressed up and go to a party, single, without a date? Spend loads of time in the mirror, and you get there and no one asks you to dance? That's what this next tune is about. Ella Fitzgerald went to a party, she says, the Duke Ellington tune, imagine my frustration, and she gets there and no one asks her to dance. Someone taps her on the shoulder and says, don't you know, my dear, no one cares, they're not impressed. She was so distressed. Imagine my frustration at no invitation to dance. One.
Thank you.
going to continue with a ballad that was written by Van and myself, and it's on my latest CD, Something for Grace, and it's entitled Reflections. Thank you. Reflection. Santa Care. Thank you. I'd like to bring the rest of the band back out. Y'all aren't off yet. We're going to end the set. Thank you so much. You've been a great audience. Thank you for getting up this early in the morning and coming to share some music with us. Such a beautiful day. I can't wait to get changed and enjoy the rest of the lineup today. You got some... No, I can't. The TV camera's on. Anyway, you got something cold to drink up there? Some Kool-Aid? We're going to end with a tune that was written by a friend of mine from Cuba, Oriente Lopez, and he calls this one Central Habana.
Welcome back. And that was the music of Regina Carter, who was performing there at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1998. And Regina Carter from Detroit gave a wonderful set just a few hours ago at the Detroit Jazz Festival in downtown Detroit. And the set was dedicated to the people of Black Bottom, who were removed by a racist administration, backed up by a racist federal government during the 1950s and 60s in the city of Detroit. A very, very bold statement, culturally, historically, and politically, by Regina Carter earlier today in the city of Detroit. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. And, of course, Regina Carter was from the city of Detroit. She attended Cass Technical High School, and she also attended the school with Carter Cook, who introduced her to Ella Fitzgerald. In high school, Carter performed with the Detroit Civic Orchestra, played in a pop-funk group named Brainstorm. In addition to taking violin lessons, she also took viola, oboe, and choir lessons. Carter was studying classical violin at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston when she decided to switch to jazz. She transferred to Oakland University, right outside Detroit in Rochester, Michigan, where she was a jazz major under the direction of Marvin Doc Holliday. She also studied and performed with trumpeter Marcus Belgrave. And this is the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit in this early Sunday morning, September 3rd, 2023. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And our lead story deals with the recently held military coup d'etat in the West Central African state of Gabon. The leader of a coup that overthrew Gabon's president, Ali Bongo, says he wants to avoid rushing into elections that repeat past mistakes as pressure mounts to hand back power to a civilian government. A spokesman for Gabon's military rulers also said on state TV, they, quote, decided with immediate effect to reopen the land, sea, and air borders as of earlier yesterday. Military officers led by General Brice Oligui Nguema seized power on Wednesday, minutes after an announcement that Bongo has secured a third term in an election. The officers placed Bongo under house arrest and installed Nguema as head of state, ending the Bongo's family's 56-year hold on power in the oil-rich state. You can read more on the situation in Gabon on the Pan-African Newswire, and also we'll have a segment on developments just over the last 4 days in the central West African state of Gabon. In other news, thousands of people have rallied in the Nigerian capital of Niamey, demanding that France withdraw its ambassador and troops from the West African country, as its new military rulers have accused Niger's former colonial ruler of interference. The protesters gathered near a base housing French soldiers after a call by several civic organizations hostile to the French military presence. They held up banners proclaiming, "French army, leave our country." Niger's military government, which seized power on July 26th, has accused French President Emmanuel Macron of using divisive rhetoric in his comments about the coup and seeking to impose a neocolonial relationship with his former colony. Macron has backed the ousted President Mohamed Bazoum and refused to recognize the new rulers. Sylvain Et, France's ambassador, has remained in Niger despite a 48-hour deadline to leave the country given more than a week ago, a decision Macron said, quote, he applauds, unquote. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. In other news, a former Italian premier in an interview published yesterday contended that a French Air Force missile accidentally brought down a passenger jet over the Mediterranean Sea in 1980, some 43 years ago, in a failed bid to assassinate Libya's then leader, Muammar Gaddafi. Former two-time premier Giuliano Amato appealed to French President Emmanuel Macron to either refute or confirm his assertion about the cause of the crash on June 27th of 1980, which killed all 81 persons aboard the Italian domestic flight. In an interview with Rome's daily La Repubblica, Amato said he is convinced that France hit the plane while targeting a Libyan military jet. While acknowledging he has no hard proof, Amato also contended that Italy tipped off Gaddafi, and so the Libyan, who was heading back to Tripoli from a meeting in Yugoslavia, didn't board the Libyan military jet. And finally, in regard to the developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there, of course, has been protest in the eastern DRC demanding that the United Nations troops there leave the country. Victims of the protest in Goma just recently that turned into clashes between protesters and the armed forces are being treated for severe injuries in nearby hospitals as national authorities estimate the death toll at more than 40 people with many injured. The protest was organized by a sect called the Natural Judaic Messianic Faith Towards the Nations and known politically as Walizindo. Nearly 160 people were arrested on Wednesday, according to communications ministries. We were just about to start marching when suddenly we saw armed Congolese soldiers coming. They immediately opened fire on the people demonstrating and on the Walizindo who were there. That was when I got hit by a bullet too, explained Claude Omar, an injured demonstrator. Goma's mayor, Faustin Napenda Kapen, had banned the protest on August the 23rd, soon after it was announced. You can read more on all of these issues over the Pan-African Newswire, including the United Nations on Friday demanded an independent probe after dozens of people were killed in a crackdown on an anti-UN protest in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. There needs to be an investigation and the perpetrators need to be brought to justice, United Nations Rights Office spokesman Ravin Shamdazani told reporters in Geneva, Switzerland. The UN is in touch with the Democratic Republic of Congo authorities to ensure a probe they have opened, quote, is independent, effective, and that measures are put in place to ensure that future demonstrations are policed in line with international human rights standards, unquote. With that, we'll conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. Including this segment of our program, we want to remind our listeners the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. Is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that is at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's program, the Pan-African Journal, Worldwide Radio Broadcasts, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We will take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Thank you.
Music of the legendary John Coltrane, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. And of course, just this last past week, there was yet another military coup d'etat, this time in the former French colony of Gabon, in the western section of Central Africa. Let's listen to a report on developments in Gabon.
A military coup in Gabon. Celebrations on the street, but a very different reaction globally. The takeover is being condemned by the UN, while China, Russia, the US, and EU all voice concern. So why has there been yet another coup in Africa? And what's the response of African states? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohamed Jimjoum. The president of Gabon, Ali Bongo, didn't have long to celebrate his election victory this week. Within minutes of the declaration that he'd won a third term, army officers announced they were taking over. The election was controversial without international observers or journalists, with the country's borders sealed. Bongo has been president since 2009, succeeding his father, who was in power since 1967. General Brice Oligui Nguema takes over as transitional leader, the army saying it wants to bring stability.
President de la transition.
The president of the transition insists on the need to maintain calm and serenity in our beautiful country. He pledges to preserve the economic tools that guarantee social prosperity at the dawn of a new era. We will guarantee the peace, stability, and dignity of our beloved Gabon.
President Ali Bongo is under house arrest. In an online message, he pleaded for support.
I don't know what's going on, so I'm calling you to make noise, really. I'm thanking you. Thank you.
We'll explore more with our guests in a moment, but first, our correspondent Nicholas Hawk has more from Senegal's capital, Dakar.
There's popular support for this coup because people have been expecting and waiting for the downfall of the Bongo family dynasty that have been at the helm of this country for over 55 years. What comes as a surprise is the man behind this coup, Brice Oligui Nguema, who is the head of the Presidential Guard, meant to protect the interests of the Bongo family. He was in fact a close aide to Omar Bongo, the father of Ali Bongo, and then in 2009 when Ali Bongo came to power, he was sidelined, sent as a defense attaché to Dakar, Senegal, and also to Morocco. During that time, the young colonel amassed quite a lot of wealth, building multi-million dollar homes in the United States and in Gabon. Now he's distancing himself from the Bongo family, arresting his son, accusing them of treason, of abusing power, of corruption, and of stealing from state coffers from this oil-rich nation in which most people live on less than $2 a day. So distancing himself, but also appeasing foreign interests, the French and the Chinese, who have vested interest in the oil business and also in the mineral business. We haven't heard from the opposition, Jean Ping, but also Albert Onda Ossa, who's been the political opponent to Ali Bongo during Saturday's presidential election. Also muted reaction from the regional countries, from Equatorial Guinea, but also from Cameroon. Not a surprise, because they probably fear a contagion of coups. Paul Biya has been in power since 1982, and President Obiang has been in power since 1979. But this coup is a break from the past, and a hope that this can rebuild trust in the democratic institutions in Gabon. Nicholas Hawk for Inside Story.
Welcome back. And we, of course, have been following the situation in the West African state of Gabon. And that was an updated report on events in that country. And, of course, we are here at the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. And, of course, we are
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests. In Libreville, capital of Gabon, is Antoine Lawson. He's a veteran journalist who's reported on Africa and Gabon for more than three decades. In Arusha, in Tanzania, is Stella Agara. She's an analyst on African government affairs. And in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, is Lassan Wedrogo, research fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development there. His work focuses on governance in West Africa. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Antoine, let me start with you today. There was jubilation across Gabon after news of the coup. You are there in Libreville. Where do things stand now?
Yes, the situation is very calm after the coup 2 days before. And the new commander-in-chief of the coup, Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema, is now the president of the transition since yesterday. Okay, everything is starting to be very quiet today, and everything, the business has opened this morning, and they ask all the population to continue to do what they have to do every day. So what is new today is that the former minister and economist, Mr. Raymond Donsima, tried to speak to the group of military officers today and ask them it was a good idea to interrupt the electoral process, and they asked them how long they are going to stay in power before they put the civil or Mr. Professor who won the election 2 days before. So the situation is still confused regarding how to lead the country, because in a response of the coup, the military says that the country is going through several institutional political crises, but now the military does not know how to lead the country. This is the more important situation now in Gabon.
Lassan, after the coup, we heard expressions of concern and condemnation from the UN, from France, the U.S., African leaders, Russia, China, and the EU. What does it mean that there is such rare international consensus on this issue within today's very polarized world?
Absolutely. I feel like the international community is caught in this coup, whereby in principle they have to condemn the coup, but at the same time it's kind of like, okay, we understand what is going on here. That's almost as if the coup is coming to relieve people from a situation whereby Ali Bongo was to win the election in a very, very controversial manner. And we don't know what could have come out of that election either in terms of post-election violence. But the coup stepped in to actually set things back to zero, basically.
Stella, General Nguema, who was named as the transitional leader, he was head of the presidential guard that had pledged to protect President Bongo. He's also related, as I understand it, to the deposed leader. The fact that such a close aide to President Bongo has now been appointed to lead the transition, what message does that impart to those inside and outside the country?
Thank you very much. And I think there are a number of things we need to consider about that appointment. One is the possibility that the more things change, the more they will remain the same. And this is truly dependent on whether Nguema himself is loyal to the deposed president or if he's truly committed to change. Sometimes you could find family members who are in total disagreement with how or why people, their family members do certain things. But if it's in alignment, it then means this will be a coup, you know, in vain, so to say. And the other thing that it says is that there's a possibility that the negotiations that are happening may impact what or the desired change in different ways. For example, for the locals, one of the things that they must do now is to manage their expectations, to stop celebrating and to find a way to communicate their interests and communicate the demands that they had for this change, if this is what they desired, especially evidenced by the celebrations we have seen amongst them. But for foreign nations, it may also present an opportunity for some of the foreign nations that have been interfering or at least influencing politics in Gabon to continue working with this gentleman to advance the agenda that they have been advancing in the region. Unfortunately, some of that agenda is not good for the country, and so they need to check to ensure that as they transition, this does not find its way into the other side of this conversation once they are able to return to constitutional order, which we kind of hope that they are going to do very soon.
Antoine, picking up on some of what Stella just said, the fact that General Nguema is part of the elite in Gabon, are there those in Gabon who are worried that this will mean that it's just more of the same going forward?
Yes, I think Mr. Nguema is a cousin of the Ali Bongo, the former president, and the Bongo era is continued because it's the same family, in fact. The Bongo has run the country since more than 50 years already, but I think if Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema stay in power again, this means that the era of Bongo continue to lead the country. It's the reason why Ali Bongo was not killed. He could have been not killed after the coup, but I think they found some arrangement, and the team tried to avoid the chaos in Gabon. Okay, what is very important is what is going after this coup. We don't think that military officers are able to lead the country as maybe the former team used to do that, because there is no minister, everything was there is no minister, the Senate, everything it was cancelled in Gabon, and the coup leader said the president is in is arrested in his residence, and you have seen yesterday, for example, the president was able to send a video on the internet. I think that they've made some arrangement.
Stella, I saw you reacting to some of what Antoine was saying there, and it looked like you wanted to jump in, so please go ahead.
So the reason why I was reacting to what he was saying is because we definitely know that, for example, the president got assistance to send out that information if he was under house arrest at the palace by the military. But more importantly is the fact that he was calling on individuals outside of the country to come out and support him. He was calling on individuals outside the country to make noise. When you start calling on people outside your country to make noise, it basically means you do not trust entirely that you have that kind of legitimacy on the ground. And the question is, what contentions do these people have against him? We already know about the number of years he has been in power, the need for change of guard in the country, the interest of the country in ensuring that then their own interests are taken care of. But speaking of calling on people outside the country, There are very many foreign governments that have spoken on this matter. There are very many foreign voices that have come in, and when I say foreign, I mean both international and African Union ECOWAS voices that have spoken on this matter. They all have very specific interests. We have governments around this country that are desperately in need of ensuring that this thing that is happening in Gabon, previously happened in Niger, does not transfer to happen in their countries. I was just interacting with some information just before the broadcast about changes that are being made in Cameroon to ensure that then the defense force has a different kind of leadership. Panicking. And then, apart from panicking, there's also the sense that this unconstitutional change of government thing is going to become a thing in the continent. We have a lot of dictators. But then there's another group of people who are coming into this conversation, like the government of France, who then are protecting their interests in something that most of those countries are fighting against.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to pick up on that point you're making about France and France's relationship with Gabon, but I also want to go to Lassane and pick up on another thing you mentioned. Lassane, Stella was talking also about the coup that happened just about 5 weeks ago in Niger, and I want to ask you how different it is what transpired in Niger versus what happened in Gabon.
You see, the Gabon coup, there's a lot of, obviously there's a lot that we don't know yet about the Gabon coup, but what we can also see in terms of a comparison with the coup in Niger is that this is more likely a very ceremonial coup d'etat, a coup d'etat whereby, you know, there has not been any internal opposition. And contrary to the coup in Niger, we have not seen people come out in protest holding foreign flags, Russian flag, unlike what we've seen in the Sahel. So basically, the reaction of the Gabonese people was in terms of, okay, now we are getting rid of this dynasty that has been in power for so long, but there's no discourse, at least for the moment, I haven't seen any response from the Gabonese people in terms of, okay, we are defending our interests, we are going to do anything to defend our interests. And if you listen to the appeal that Bongo issued on a video call, he did it on in English, not in French. I understand that Gabon is now part of the Commonwealth, which is also something to consider here. Why is Gabon, a former French colony, a member of the Commonwealth? What has been going on in terms of the Franco-Gabonese relationship to the point where Gabon will seek to join the Commonwealth? So I think if we go back a few years ago when, maybe not a few years, a few months ago when Macron visited Gabon to talk about climate change and everything, the Gabonese people's reaction to the arrival of the president of France was also showing signs that there's a disconnection between, or at least there's a departure from what we have always known as France-Afrique, France in Africa.
Lassane, let me also ask you further about the reactions that we've heard thus far from African leaders and institutions. You know, on Wednesday, Nigerian President Bola Tinubu, he's the current chair of the West African bloc, ECOWAS. He said he was working closely with other African leaders to contain what he called a contagion of autocracy spreading across Africa. Time after time when these coups happen, and there have been a lot of coups, as we mentioned earlier, recently, we see condemnation from African leaders, and we hear talk of proposals to try to settle these disputes and end these crises, but not much seems to happen. Why have these institutions and leaders not been more effective?
I think that these institutions have failed fundamentally to address the symptoms, the reason, the root causes of coup d'etats. They rather come late to address the symptoms when the disease is already in. And today it's sad to say it, but it's no longer a matter of what is next. It's, we can even say it's a matter of who is next, because we see a number of African countries where the situation is not good at all. The situation, the governance situation is very bad, and our regional organizations are not reacting to that. They are not reacting and saying, look, the election is not going well. Even Tinubu himself, he has not been, you know, he has been recently elected, but the election has issues. Fortunately, the Nigerian people took the case to the court, and that is being decided while the president has sworn in to be a president. I think that itself is a very problematic issue that our regional organization, African Union, needed to address. But since we failed to address those, what comes next when the military see an opportunity to seize power? And we shouldn't forget that those are also citizens, and they have families who are members of our communities, and they understand the predicament in which those kind of poor leadership is taking them into.
Antoine, often when news of these coups emerge, there's a lot of talk about democratic backsliding in a volatile region. I want to ask you if it's fair to mention that in the context of what happened in Gabon, because there had been a lot of allegations that fraud had taken place in the elections over the weekend. The Bongo family has ruled Gabon for 56 years. So is it actually accurate to say that the coup is evidence of erosion of democracy in Gabon?
But I don't think so. The main problem in Gabon is that the population is getting poor and poor. This is a population, Gabon is a population of less than 2 million inhabitants, and the half of the population is living in the capital, Libreville. In the, there is 9 regions in Gabon, but Libreville is the capital. There is about more than around 1 million inhabitants in Libreville. And the people are living very difficult for the everyday living, for the families, and they don't understand why there is a group of people in power. They use the money and they spread the money, and they don't have anything to eat, for example, because in Gabon, there are some families that don't have more than $2 a day for the everyday living. You know, the country is rich. We have oil, we have wood, and there's some raw material like manganese, but it was possible for all the what we have in Gabon to be able to have a very good country like in Libya, for example. Gabon was one of the richest country in Africa. And now we see there is in Equatorial Guinea, there is some more development. The population is small, but they have enough money. But the money in Gabon is not distributed very equally to all the sections of the population. This is a problem. People are not glad for it, but they think that this coup maybe can bring something better, but I am not sure, because the people, the military on the power now, maybe they don't know how to run the country.
Stella, I had interrupted you earlier when you were starting to make a point about Gabon's relationship with France. Gabon, like Niger, was also a former French colony. Gabon is one of France's closest allies in the region. How much influence is France losing across the region at this point?
I'm glad you asked that question, and I'm glad you interrupted me so that this conversation could go around, because I want to pick up from where Antoine has left. Gabon has been led by this family dynasty for over 55 years, and so it is not that is the main trigger now for them to get rid of their president. The environment is ripe for a coup because of the other circumstances that are leading to this. We are coming out of a pandemic. We are currently at the center of a global economic recession, and these people have to figure out how to survive. The relationship with France is such that Gabon is one of the nations that has been paying colonial tax to the government of France, up to the tune of $500 billion USD. That is not small money, considering that it's collected from 14 of the poorest nations in the region. Gabon happens to be a very wealthy country, and I think Antoine has mentioned about their wealth in manganese, timber, and oil, etc. And so they're definitely paying a lot out, and yet their people are staying hungry. At some point, when you push an individual and push a citizen to the wall, eventually they're going to be knee-jerk reactions. And part of the reason why France is losing influence in the region is because all of those countries are beginning to ask, why do we have wealth? Why do we have resources, and we have to pay so much outside? That, of course, would explain why there are military coups. But apart from having military coups, there's resistance also to the voice of France asking them about anything, or at least taking a moral high ground on their situation. And you have seen those kinds of situations repeating themselves, even to the point of Niger. France is losing influence because this thing that they continue to do is an injustice to those countries, even if you are collecting compensation for what you built in a country during at the time when you're colonizing them, surely you cannot collect compensation in perpetuity. Number two is that the influence that has been held over that region has not changed the region in any way. In any case, it has continued to put these people under abject poverty, with people living on less than $1 or $2 a day. And of course, that kind of indignity cannot be sustained or accepted by humans for a very long time. At some point, it has to stop. Unfortunately, the people who suffer are the women and the children in the society, because coups generally do not recognize the interests of women and children, and many of them do not rise to the top even after a coup.
Lassana, we spoke a little bit earlier about the international condemnation that we've heard thus far from several international actors. I want to ask you, where do you see this going forward when it comes to the reaction in the days, weeks, and months ahead from the international players? And is there an international actor that would be able to step in from your vantage point and actually try to resolve any of this?
I think the international community involvement in Gabon will be purely based on specific interests that each one of those countries have in Gabon. When the Chinese issue a statement, they condemn the coup, but they do not address the question of the election, whether the election was fair and transparent. Nobody is talking about that. And in that matter, the opposition and the Guinean, the Gabonese people are the losers in this story. When the French condemned the coup, they do not condemn it the same energy which they have used to condemn the coups in Niger and elsewhere. When the rest of the West condemned the coup, including African Union, and you know, it's just a basic way of saying, look, in principle, we do not agree with coup d'etats. But I'm quite sure that all of these international actors are going to find ways to maintain the system. You know, there will not be a lot of pressure on this military regime to transition quickly toward to give power to civilians. And if they do that, they will also work toward maintaining the same statu quo that allowed the international partners, which I believe are equally liable to the suffering of the Guinean the Gabonese people, in as much as they have been involved for many years working with Bongo Father and Ali Bongo. It's so unfair to the Gabonese people when you think that this nation is extremely rich in natural resources and only has 2 million people. That is, for God's sake, less than the size of the population of Abuja or Lagos or Ouagadougou for that. So it doesn't make sense that with such a small number of people, we are unable to meet their basic needs, and at the same time you are collaborating with nations that claim to be democratic. It doesn't make any sense. It's just ridiculous. And
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are very much running out of time. We only have about a minute and a half left, and I just want to give the last word to Antoine, because he is there in Libreville on the ground. Antoine, please keep in mind we only have about a minute and a half left. I just want to ask you about the fact that the military is promising stability. From your vantage point and from what you're hearing from others in Gabon, do you think that's possible?
I think it is possible. Yes, you have to be optimist what can be done for the country. But I think that France, President Macron, has to change the way they lead the politics in the African French-speaking countries. This is very important, because what they are doing in Africa since maybe 50 years is to take everything from African community and say, don't give nothing in return. This is very important to develop a country. There is something the French people, the French government has to do, and they know now things are changing, and what happened in Niger, in Burkina Faso, everything move now in Central Africa, in Gabon. Maybe in a few months, in a few years, something will happen in Equatorial Guinea or in Congo. This is certain, because this is a very good position for Africans to make politics, and this is not good for the democratic view of the African country. This is a shame to see that now
people cannot live and reserve another very rich, the country is rich, and people cannot have, there is no student. All the 80% of the students in Gabon are learning in Europe, in America,
Antoine,
in Canada. There
Antoine,
is no university in Gabon.
Antoine, I am sorry to cut you off, but we have run out of time. Thanks so much to you and all of our other guests, Antoine Lawson, Stella Agara, and Lassan Wadrago. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.
That was a report, the recent political and military developments in the state of Gabon, a former French colony in the western regions of Central Africa. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for the early morning hour of Sunday, September 3rd, 2023, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into a segment on Niger and its standoff with the French Foreign Ministry. Let's listen in.
Niger's coup leaders and France are in a standoff. The military wants to cut ties with the former colonial power. President Macron refuses to recognize their takeover. So how might this end? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Folie Batibo. 5 weeks ago, Niger was seen as the West's most stable ally in the Sahel region of Africa. But a coup at the end of July has turned that upside down. Ousted President Mohamed Bazoum is under house arrest. The former colonial power, France, refuses to recognize the military takeover. President Emmanuel Macron insists his ally Bazoum is still the legitimate leader. Demonstrators waving Russian as well as Nigerian flags want to cut links with France, accusing it of exploitation. So how might this end? We'll talk to our guests in just a moment, but first let's hear from Niger and our correspondent Ahmed Idris.
The security forces at this military base on our right are having a difficult time controlling the crowd. An unprecedented number of protesters have besieged the military base here in Escadre. They want to move in forcefully to confront the French soldiers. An estimated 1,500 French soldiers are thought to be or believed to be inside this camp, and they want them out. One of the main defense and military agreements between Niger and France has expired last night. And so, because of that, they are ramping up pressure on the French to move out. And on the part of the military junta, they also have given directives that they want the French ambassador to Niger, whose deadline to move out of the country has expired about a week ago. They want to evict him out of his residence or out of his embassy, wherever he is, to move out of the country because they said his diplomatic immunity and status and that of his family have been revoked. Now, people here in Niger, including the military junta, feel that the country has not been treated fairly in the imposition of sanctions by the economic community of West Africa states. Analysts and activists say those sanctions are impacting more on the ordinary people on the streets here in Niger Republic. Remember, Niger is a country that is largely dependent on financial and food aid from the international community. Now, with the suspension of operations of non-governmental organizations, as well as the sanctions imposed by the African Union, the Economic Community of West African States, and other international institutions, things are getting more and more difficult for the ordinary Nigerian. Inflation has also gone through the roof. Ahmed Idris, Al Jazeera for Inside Story in Yemen.
Well, let's take a look at links between France and Niger. France colonized the West African country in 1898 and ruled for more than 60 years. Niger gained its independence in 1960, and despite local hostility, some French troops remain until today. France imports uranium from Niger and is its top export partner. Regional and European leaders have condemned the coup. They say French troops must remain in the fight against rebel groups in the Sahel region. But coup supporters say they are fed up with a former colonial power telling their country what to do. Well, let's bring in our guest now for today's show. Joining us from Paris is Nicolas Normand. He's a former French ambassador to Mali, Senegal, and the Republic of the Congo. From Abuja is Kabir Adamu. He's managing director at Beacon Consultancy, a security risk management consultancy. And joining us from Cape Town is Leonard Mbulenzige. He's a researcher at the Institute for Democracy, Citizenship and Public Policy in Africa at the University of Cape Town. A warm welcome to you all, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on Inside Story. Ambassador Nicolas Normand in Paris, let me start with you if I can. The people of Niger, not just the junta, wants to cut ties with France. Why is France digging in its heels? Why refuse to comply with the expulsion order for Sylvain Ité?
Well, the answer is simple. France does not recognize the coup leaders as a legal president. You know that despite being detained and despite being under pressure, President Bazoum, the former president, the legal president, the elected president, has not resigned. So France recognizes him as the sole president and does not want to comply with an expulsion order or any order coming from the coup leaders, from the junta.
Yeah. Well, we had somewhat of a similar situation, Ambassador, in Mali, where there was also a coup there. The French ambassador was recalled by Paris then. What's different between that situation and this one, where some say France is putting its envoy at risk?
It's very different because in Mali, the president did resign. He did sign a letter of resignation. That's not the case at all in Niger. So the situation in Niger is very peculiar, very strange, because there are two presidents, actually, one legal and one de facto president. And we recognize only the legal one. We must also stress that the President Bazoum, the one who is detained, still gets in touch, gets in contact with world leaders, including French presidents. We must also stress that he was a strong ally of France.
Right. We did indeed hear from President Macron, who said he spoke to President Bazoum on the phone almost every day. But what I wanted to get from you, Ambassador Normand, is find out why France is today willing to put the safety and security of its soldiers who are in Niger at risk, and also of its ambassador at risk, by digging in on this issue.
Well, the French have taken a very firm position, a very firm stance. In my own opinion, it's a lost cause because President Bazoum will not not get power again. He will not be handed power back, you know. So we are on a very inflexible, very... President Macron is very adamant about that, but finally we will have to pull out from Niger. The ambassador will finally be expelled because there will be finally a solution to the stalemate which is the current situation from a political point of view.
Do you think President Macron's close relationship with President Bazoum is what's guiding his decisions and his actions on Niger right now?
Well, you know, President Macron hoped at first that President Bazoum would be restored to power under the pressure, well, because the coup leaders were under the pressure of the sanctions of the ECOWAS, the local regional organization. But the coup leaders are also very inflexible. They are very adamant that they are going to keep their power. So it is really a stalemate.
Yeah.
And I think finally the winner will be the coup leaders.
Okay, let's bring in Kabir into the conversation. Kabir, as Ambassador Normand just said there, we are in a stalemate, a standoff, and each side seems to be digging in. How, first of all, do you evaluate the way France has handled this crisis in Niger, and how do you think the Nigerian army, the new leadership, will eventually respond?
Well, it's clearly a stalemate and an escalation of a very delicate situation. It appears to me that France is looking for an excuse, as it were, to use possibly some element of force within Niger. Otherwise, I cannot see how France is endangering a very critical component of its foreign relations, its ambassador, and then the military deployment in Niger. Part of the argument is the interpretation of the agreement that allows France to deploy troops. On the Nigerian side, the junta has been, they've given Niger a month, which is speculated within the agreement. And then the French side is saying, no, you do not have the legitimacy to issue that ultimatum of 1 month. So it's a very interesting period in international relations. How this plays out may become precedent, as it were, for the interpretation of the sovereignty of states to take certain actions. And the tendency for this to escalate into a bigger issue is extremely high. The video that you've shown with people stationed right outside the embassy, anything could go wrong at that point in time. And I know indeed. The ability of...
Yeah, indeed. It is a very tense situation. Leonard, your thoughts about how France has handled this situation in Niger and also perhaps how the military is handling it right now, the new leadership. They seem to be adamant and at the same time cautious, it would seem, as to what they do next.
Yes, I think France has taken a zero-sum approach so far. However, they're trying to take this approach. Meanwhile, they don't have leverage to pursue that because, as the ambassador stated, they don't legally recognize the military junta in power. However, in practice, they have been controlling affairs for the past month. They've been able to establish relations with regional powers. And despite their suspension from ECOWAS and the African Union, they've still been able to maintain control over the extent of the territory, as well as to pursue various political, socioeconomic, and other society-wide engagements.
Kabir doesn't agree with you on that. Kabir.
Yeah, so just to correct the point around their ability that they've been able to establish relations with regional authorities, no. ECOWAS still describes the development as an attempted coup. AU describes the development as an attempted coup. The only element that has remained more or less neutral is the United States. They've called it, they are yet to call it a coup. They've sent envoys to Niger. And again, the interpretation of an envoy meeting an illegitimate government, depending on where you stand in international relations, is of course subject to that interpretation on whether that is recognition or not. But it's clear that all the multilateral agencies have not recognized the coup in Niger.
Okay. Ambassador, well, let me come back to you. All right. Leonard, go ahead. Go ahead and respond, and then I'll come back to the ambassador. Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't say regional authority, regional neighbors, for example, Mali and Burkina Faso have stipulated their support, and they even sent military aid in the form of jets to Niger in the event that there was going to be an ECOWAS regional military force deployed to that country. They haven't gotten a full endorsement, but nevertheless, Guinea's military government has also condemned the sanctions. So I didn't say at a regional institutional level. I've noted that African Union and ECOWAS has suspended them. But nevertheless, they have gotten the endorsement and support from regional neighbors such as Mali and Burkina Faso, which also have military governments.
Yeah, regional neighbors, which are also under sanctions because of the coups in those countries, in Mali and Burkina Faso, it's worth pointing out. Ambassador, let me come back to you. And Kabir mentioned the relationship with the U.S. there and the U.S. not recognizing this as a coup. I'll come back to that in just a moment because there have been some reports that suggest that there is some tension perhaps between Paris and Washington right now on this issue of Niger. But I wanted to ask you about the question of military intervention. Kabir said that perhaps the French could be looking for an excuse to intervene militarily in Niger. Would France do that, you think, if perhaps ECOWAS was to ask for some sort of intervention? Would France intervene militarily?
Well, the threat of ECOWAS to have a military intervention is not credible. They have not the means to do it, and politically it is not feasible. You know, there will be a crowd preventing them from going forward and so on. So there will be no military intervention by ECOWAS, and no, neither by ECOWAS nor by France. France for France, it's totally ruled out anyway. The problem is not that. The problem is that the French are diplomatically isolated. You mentioned the American stance. The Americans are the most flexible. They have not even recognized that there is a coup. They say it is an effort to interrupt a normal process or to seize power by force. It is an effort to disrupt the constitution. It is at most an attempted coup, but it's not a coup. For France, it is a coup. We are clear about that. But we are the only country within Europe to support the idea of a military intervention by ECOWAS, even if it is not credible. So we have a very hostile stance against Niger, and this is a bit awkward because finally the winner are the coup leaders who can denounce France as a hostile power. So they take advantage of that, you know, because there is a strong anti-French sentiment in Niamey, the capital, and so they capitalize on that. So French give them means to be more anti-French, you know.
Kabir, let me come to you. The ambassador talked there about a possible military intervention by ECOWAS, and they did threaten to intervene, but that seems to have somewhat become more quiet now. Do you think that's likely to happen, an intervention by ECOWAS?
I agree with the ambassador that it's theoretically, I wouldn't use the word impossible, but difficult. Military interventions can have different explanations and manifestations. Now, given the size of Niger, and several other issues, including, for instance, the political element that the ambassador spoke about. If you use Nigeria as an example, clearly the president has not gotten the kind of support he would have wanted. But there is a constitutional provision that would allow him to use executive powers if it comes to that. Now, other regional powers, such as Cote d'Ivoire and to an extent Ghana, have also indicated support for such a military intervention. Now, there are several determinants, but I think the most important one that we should not run away from is the domino effect that the heads of states of ECOWAS member states seem to be running away from. When you have a situation where someone is protecting his own position, then anything can happen. So I wouldn't use impossible, but it is difficult.
All right. Leonard Mbule Nzinge, the ambassador, alluded to the fact that the military in Niger, the new leadership there, has been capitalizing on this growing anti-French sentiment there. And we've seen huge protests outside the French embassy, the French military base. It's unclear whether that is reflective, of course, of the wider population, because I imagine that those against the coup would not be able to speak freely about it. How much longer do you think the new military leadership can continue to capitalize on this? Is there a clear plan in place, you think, they have to move the country forward and transition to democracy? Do they have a plan in place?
As you said, the military has done quite a good job in trying to use the anti-French sentiment as a mobilization strategy, as well as to derive political capital and support beyond Niger's borders, as they've seen in Mali and Burkina Faso and beyond, as well as on social media. People have saluted the coup and the fact that they consider it a way of pushing away France from continued influence in the country and some sort of second independence for Niger as a country and the West African region in general. Concerning the way forward, I think that the military junta is trying to buy time. If they expel the ambassador, it situates that, you know, the international influence, which was most adamant to have them return Bazoum the power wouldn't necessarily have a representative on the ground. And symbolically, that's very important because, as I said, the ambassador is the representative of France's government. And if he's not there, it indicates that, there's a way forward in terms of engaging with other international partners such as the U.S., which have been more pragmatic. And as the ambassador described, they haven't necessarily termed it as a coup. So
right.
I think that the buying time, but then the plan isn't necessarily as clear as one would expect after this amount of time in control of Niger.
Kabir, do you agree with that? They're buying time, and how long do you think they can ride on this anti-French sentiment wave?
It's going to be a battle between the effect of the economic sanction. Of course, they are banking on the local support that they've been able to gather so far. But then at a point, Nigerians will have to choose between supporting them and then, of course, the effect of the sanctions on them. We're already seeing that playing out. The second point is there's a rally now around a short transition period. Just earlier this week, the Nigerian president mooted at the idea of a 9-month transition period. Before then, the Algerians put forward a 6-month transition period, but the junta had indicated a 3-year period. So I think that's what the next step would be, transition period. And then, of course, the various multilateral partners, the diplomatic bilateral partners would also come in to agree around that. The time period for that transition.
Ambassador Normand, what is the next step as far as France is concerned, Ambassador? If, as you say, reinstating Bazoum is a lost cause, then what happens next? How does France settle this crisis?
Well, it will end up by a France withdrawal. There is no doubt about that. But the problem is that who is the winner in this crisis? The winner are the jihadists. You know, there is a very serious insurgency, an Islamist insurgency in this country. The French were there only to assist the Nigerian army to fight the jihadists.
What about France's economic interests, Ambassador, in Niger? It's uranium mining. France needs uranium, its energy needs in Niger. What about that? I mean, isn't that a concern for France, its energy independence?
It's not important for France. We have many other providers. Niger is a small producer of uranium, and the main producers for France, the main providers for France are Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Australia, and Canada. So we don't need Niger and its uranium. We were there only for security interests and to fight terrorism. And you know, the coup leaders are not really interested in fighting the jihadists. They are interested in their personal gains. They took power to enrich themselves, not to improve the situation in terms of security.
Right.
This is not their motive. It's clear. It is clear.
Okay, both Kabir and Leonard seem to disagree with you. Kabir, I'll start with you. The ambassador says France wasn't there for its interest. It's not interested in Niger's uranium and that it was just there to help the fight against armed groups in the region. What do you respond?
In summary, I mean, it's very important that France recognizes that its post-colonial policies in Africa is failing or has failed. Why are we not seeing the type of reactions in other countries? Why is it that it's only in French former colonies that we're seeing that? So it's absolutely important that France starts from that point of view. Now, speaking about security, about economic interests, the reality on ground is different. It's French companies that are mining the uranium. The agreements are skewed in the favor of France, not in the favor of Niger. And there's no part of the economy of Niger that you speak about that does not reflect that. Then with regards to security, despite the presence of French troops in Niger and the Sahel, Sahel has emerged as the most terrorist-ravaged part of the world at the moment. So it's very difficult to convince the Nigerian. I mean, as an academic, I can look at the data and look at other considerations. But for the average Nigerian, it's almost impossible to convince him that the French presence there is in his interest. And that is what France needs to deal with.
Okay, Leonard, your response to what the ambassador said.
Yeah, I have to fully disagree. I mean, you look at the post-colonial cooperation accord, the cooperation agreement, and they stipulated that, you know, France should have preferential access to the various precious minerals, including uranium. And, you know, French companies such as what was formerly known as Areva, I think they're called Orano, have had preferential access and have derived significant benefits and profits as a result of unrivaled competition by carrying out activities in Niger. I'd like to ask the ambassador how France would feel if, for example, the Chinese or, say, the Russians would have access to that uranium. And that's something which, you know, in terms of French, not only foreign policy, but as well as overseas economic diplomacy, is not an option that they would like to have entertained. So saying that France is only there for security motives, I mean, the security issues in Niger and the Sahel only emerged over the past 10 to 15 years, say 20, and if you want to be extensive. But then France's involvement with respect to uranium extraction has prevailed for almost 60 years. So
let's allow the ambassador to respond. Let's allow the ambassador to respond. Ambassador, a good question that Leonard poses there. How would France feel if the Chinese or the Russians were to get access to the uranium in Niger?
Well, you know, those agreements that were mentioned are fakes. There are no such agreements. There is no preferential access for the French. This is totally wrong. It's a fake agreement. I must stress that fact. And also, if we wanted to keep those uranium mines, we would get along with the junta. We would get along with any government. It's not the case at all. We neglect our possible economical interest in that crisis, given that we stick to principles only. So we were there at the request of the government, the same in Mali and Burkina. If the governments do not want the French to assist them in the fighting against the jihadists, we are going to step down, to withdraw from those countries. But it is already the case in Mali and Burkina Faso. And in the, following the withdrawal of the French, the security situation has deteriorated a lot.
Ambassador, sorry to interrupt you because we're coming towards the end of the show, but I just wanted to put this question to you. Isn't the reality of the situation today that France is losing its last strategic foothold in this region, in the West Africa Sahel region, where other coups have already, as you mentioned, forced it to withdraw troops elsewhere in Mali and Burkina Faso? Is this a strategic defeat, but also a psychological defeat today for France?
You are right. It is a humiliation because we have not adjusted our position to the changes on the ground. But you know, the loser is not the French because we have no strong interest in the region aside from fighting the terrorists. So the loser are the countries. But as I told you, their interest is not in fighting terrorists. Their interest is for the military, for the coup leaders to seize power for themselves, for their personal gains. This is really a tragedy because the situation is deteriorating because of those selfish interests.
Kabir, in Abuja, I'll give you the last word. The ambassador says the loser is not France. What are your thoughts about this, and what next in this crisis? How do you see it ending?
The premise of the ambassador's assumption is that African countries are not capable. Now, there is some element of truth in that, but that does not allow the possibility that perhaps at this point in time, African countries are waking up to the reality that they can do better. And I think the next stage, which we hope to see from African leaders, is an investment in human capital to allow for management and control of the resources within Africa. It will take time, but that process has to begin. In terms of the resolution of the crisis, I've mentioned earlier on, there is a rallying around a shorter transition period. And I think that's what the next few days would tell us. Depending on how this escalation of the situation between Niger and France goes.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for a very insightful discussion. Thank you, Ambassador Nicolas Normand, Kabir Adamu, Leonard Mbule Nzige. Thank you for joining us on Inside Story. And thank you, too, for watching. You can always watch this program again anytime by visiting our website at aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/AJInsideStory. Of course, you can join the conversation on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle is at AJInsideStory. From me, Fully Batibor, and the whole team here in Doha, thanks for watching. Bye for now.
Good evening. This is Dan McCloskey with a special one-hour version of All Night Jazz tonight. We'll be presenting part one of a two-part interview with jazz pianist Horace Silver. Part two will be heard tomorrow night, that's Sunday night, at midnight. We'll be right back. That's the Cape Verdean Blues on Blue Note with the Horace Silver Quintet. And we have with us tonight on All Night Jazz a very fine, well-known jazz pianist and composer, Horace Silver. How you doing?
Hi, Dan. I'm fine. And yourself?
Well, getting ready to play some nice sides tonight.
I hope they're some of ours.
Well, I think they're all yours.
Good.
I've been going through for the last 2 days and listening to a lot of the different records, listening carefully and trying to research it out. Maybe we should just start off by giving a very, very brief history of what you've done in the past, going back to the days when you started out with Stan Getz.
Well, I left Connecticut with Stan Getz. I was with him for about a year. I sort of owe him a debt of gratitude for taking me out of Connecticut. You know, I wanted to come to the big city and try to make good, but sometimes when you're a young teenager, you know, or in your early 20s or something, you get cold feet, you know. And he came right up into Hartford and heard me and hired me, and was with him for a year. And it was a very pleasurable experience. And then I settled in New York City for, well, from then up until now, I still live in New York City, but I had to get my 802 card, which meant that I had to live in New York for 6 months and only work weekends or a few jobs like that. You couldn't really work on a steady basis until you got your card. And I was doing a lot of work at Birdland, as a side man, you know. I used to go down there during the daytime and practice the piano because I had no piano where I was living in the Bronx. And the manager, Oscar Goodstein, was a very nice fellow, and he used to let me in when there was nobody rehearsing there, and I could practice there. And he would sometimes put together groups, you know, for a week or two at Birdland, and if they needed the piano player, he would always recommend me. And I worked down there quite a bit with various groups. And then I happened to get a gig with Art Blakey with a big band he had, well, 9 or 10 piece band that he had.
Was that called the Original Jazz Messengers?
I don't remember what that was called, to tell you the truth. But it was a fine band. It's sort of reminiscent of some of the semi-big bands that Tad Dameron used to record years ago, you know, when he did Focus and Our Delight and those things. It was a fine band, but we couldn't get no gigs, only one-nighters, you know, dances and club affairs and stuff like that. No nightclubs, or maybe a one-night at Birdland on a Monday night or something. But then later on, we got into the quintet thing, and it started to happen a little bit more frequently.
Started to cook then. That was the original Art Blakey Horace Silver Quintet.
Well, no, it was just called.
It was originally
called the Jazz Messengers.
Uh-huh.
Period. Just the Jazz Messengers, and then it became Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. The original Jazz Messengers started out with Kenny Durham and Doug Watkins, Hank Mobley, Art Blakey, and myself, and then Donald Byrd replaced Kenny Durham, and we were together for about a year, year and a half, or something like that, and then. I left the group, and a few other people left the group. The group sort of broke up there for a time, you know, and I really, what I intended to do at that time was to take a little rest, you know, 2 or 3 months off, and like a vacation or something, you know. And then I was thinking about joining another band as a sideman again, but several friends of mine told me I should get my own group, and I really sort of lacked a little confidence in myself at that time about having a group of my own. I really didn't want all those headaches, you know, which goes with being a leader, you know. Guy in Philadelphia that owned the Showboat there, jazz club there, he offered me a week's work as a leader, so I took him up on it and got some guys together, and we rehearsed. It was Hank Mobley and Art Farmer and Lewis Hayes and Doug Watkins. And we did pretty well that week, and we got a few other weeks' work, and it kept growing, and here I am today with the quintet. And
yeah. Can we go back a little bit, play something from your original recordings with Stan Getz, play something called Penny. This is going to Tommy Potter in there, and Roy Haynes and some other people, Jimmy Rainey on guitar.
No, Jimmy Rainey's not on that track, I believe. This is the two fellows that are on this track with Stan and myself are two very good friends of mine from Hartford, Connecticut. And they left Connecticut the same time I did and joined Stan Getz. Joe Calloway on bass, I don't believe he plays anymore. Walter Boland on drums, I believe he's still performing around New York City.
Well, let's do that then. Play Penny. And then from this album, which was recorded back in 1952 and 53 on Blue Note, it's called the Horace Silver Trio, a little thing called Safari. chorus over there. First, Penny. Original recording was Stan Getz back in 1950, and then Safari. Horace Silver Trio on Blue Note. Well, very first. That was probably the first Blue Note album, wasn't it?
That I did, yes. Mm-hmm. As a leader, that is. I had made a couple of records on Blue Note with Lou Donaldson prior to that.
The Jazz Messengers, I was reading about this, something that Art Blakey described them as. It literally meant a group that played to get the jazz message across, and if you were watching the audience and they weren't snapping their fingers and tossing their heads and really cooking, then you weren't getting the message across. Is that a fair statement to make?
Oh, yeah, that's very true. I go along with that all the way.
That must really have influenced you then, or either that or you influenced Art Blakey into that.
No, I don't think either. I think we just both feel the same way about things, more or less. Sort of thinking the same vein. that was to beat or not to beat.
A little play on Shakespeare.
We hope you enjoyed it.
An up-tempo thing. I've got some questions I wanted to ask you, Horace, about composing. There must be some kind of special method you have. I noticed that you sometimes go off for a while.
No, there's no special method for me in composing. I doubt if there is for anybody. But I know there's no special method for me. I love to write, and you know, the good Lord has given me the ability to write, and the main thing is just to apply yourself, I would say. You know, inspiration comes from various sources, no one source, and you just have to sit down and just fool around and see what you come up with, you know.
You do it all on the piano then?
Not always. Sometimes I do it away from the piano. Sometimes I do it in my hotel room or on a train or something like that, you know. But mostly I do it at home on the piano because I, in my leisurely hours when I'm really relaxed, you know, I think you can think better then, you know. But sometimes I might be relaxed laying around my hotel room and I get an idea and I jot it down on the back of something. But mostly the atmosphere at home, you know, where I can really just lounge around and relax. I seem to come up with more ideas.
Back in New York?
Yes.
Is a lot of it influenced by going away on a foreign trip? I noticed like the Cape Verdean blues or the...
Some of it is, yeah.
Tokyo?
Yeah, that was very inspirational, my trip to Japan. But inspiration comes from various sources, you know. Can come from a foreign trip, come from different sources of music other than jazz, you know, folk music, rock and roll, classical music, Indian music, Spanish or Portuguese or what have you, you know.
Have you been to India yet?
No, I would love to go, though. That really would be an experience, I think.
I'd love to see what would come out of that, because there are definite selections on some of your albums that really give a certain feeling. Your music tends to place the listener in a certain kind of atmosphere outside of a, you know, a room just listening to music. I felt like I was in Japan when I listened to Ah So. Or things like that, or Dragon Lady.